called 2 days ago, and had the pleasure of finding me completely delirious and half out of my mind. He's somehow managed to lay the blame for all this on himself. If he were anyone else, I would have had him demoted.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, sir. And please forgive me. I never meant to cause additional problems.
You are in no danger from me, Lieutenant.
I'm so sorry, sir,
he whispers. His shoulders fall. His head bows. His apologies are making me uncomfortable. Have the troops reassemble at 1300 hours. I still need to address them about these recent developments.
Yes, sir,
he says. He nods once without looking up. You are dismissed.
Sir.
He drops his salute and disappears. I'm left alone in front of her door. Funny how accustomed I'd become to visiting her here. How it gave me a strange sense of comfort to know that she and I were living in the same building. Her presence on base changed everything for me. The weeks she spent here became the first I ever enjoyed living in these quarters. I looked forward to her temper, her tantrums, her ridiculous arguments. I wanted her to yell at me. I would have congratulated her had she ever slapped me in the face. I was always pushing her, toying with her emotions. I wanted to meet the real girl trapped behind the fear. I wanted her to finally break free of her own carefully constructed restraints. Because while she might be able to feign timidity within the confines of isolation, out here, amid chaos, destruction, I knew she'd become something entirely different. I was just waiting, every day, patiently waiting for her to understand the breadth of her own potential, never realizing I'd entrusted her to the one soldier who might take her away from me. I should shoot myself for it. Instead, I open the door. The panel slides shut behind me as I cross the threshold. I find myself alone, standing here, in the last place she touched. The bed is messy and unmade, the doors to her armoire hanging open, the broken window temporarily taped shut. There's a sinking, nervous pain in my stomach that I choose to ignore. Focus. I step into the bathroom and examine the toiletries, the cabinets, even the inside of the shower. Nothing. I walk back over to the bed and run my hand over the rumpled comforter, the lumpy pillows. I allow myself a moment to appreciate the evidence that she was once here. And then I strip the bed. Sheets, pillowcases, comforter, and duvet, all tossed to the floor. I scrutinize every inch of the pillows, the mattress, and the bed frame, and again find nothing. The side table, nothing. Under the bed, nothing. The light fixtures, the wallpaper, each individual piece of clothing in her armoire, nothing. It's only as I'm making my way toward the door that something catches my foot. I look down. There, caught just under my boot, is a thick, faded rectangle. A small, unassuming notebook that could fit in the palm of my hand. And I'm so stunned that for a moment I can't even move. 9. How could I have forgotten? This notebook was in her pocket the day she was making her escape. I'd found it just before Kent put a gun to my head, and at some point in the chaos I must have dropped it. And I realize I should have been looking for this all along. I bend down to pick it up, carefully shaking out bits and pieces of glass from the pages. My hand is unsteady, my heart pounding in my ears. I have no idea what this might contain. Pictures, notes, scrambled, half-formed thoughts. It could be anything. I flip the notebook over in my hands, my fingers memorizing its rough, worn surface. The cover is a dull shade of brown, but I can't tell if it's been stained by dirt and age, or if it was always this color. I wonder how long she's had it. where she might have acquired it. I stumble backward, the backs of my legs hitting her bed. My knees buckle and I catch myself on the edge of the mattress. I take in a shaky breath and close my eyes. I'd seen footage from her time in the asylum, but it was essentially useless. The lighting was always too dim. The small window did little to illuminate the dark corners of her room. She was often an indistinguishable form, a dark shadow one might never even notice. Our cameras were only good at detecting movement, and maybe a lucky moment when the sun hit her at the right angle. But she rarely moved. Most of her time was spent sitting very, very still, on her bed or in a dark corner. She almost never spoke, and when she did, it was never in words. She spoke only in numbers. Counting. There was something so unreal about her, sitting there. I couldn't even see her face, couldn't discern the outline of her figure. Even then, she fascinated me. That she could seem so calm, so still. She would sit in one place for hours at a time, unmoving, and I always wondered where she was in her mind, what she might be thinking, how she could possibly exist in that solitary world. More than anything else, I wanted to hear her speak. I was desperate to hear her voice. I'd always expected her to speak in a language I could understand. I thought she'd start with something simple, maybe something unintelligible. But the first time we ever caught her talking on camera, I couldn't look away. I sat there, transfixed, nerves stretched thin, as she touched one hand to the wall and counted. 4,572. I watched her count to 4,572. It took 5 hours. Only afterward did I realize she was counting her breaths. I couldn't stop thinking about her after that. I was distracted long before she arrived on base, constantly wondering what she might be doing and whether she'd speak again. If she wasn't counting out loud, was she counting in her head? Did she ever think in letters, complete sentences? Was she angry, sad? Why did she seem so serene for a girl I'd been told was a volatile, deranged animal? Was it a trick? I'd seen every piece of paper documenting the critical moments in her life. I'd read every detail in her medical records and police reports. I'd sorted through school complaints, doctor's notes, her official sentencing by the reestablishment, and even the asylum questionnaire submitted by her parents. I knew she'd been pulled out of school at 14. I knew she'd been through severe testing and was forced to take various and dangerous experimental drugs and had to undergo electroshock therapy. In 2 years, she'd been in and out of 9 different juvenile detention centers and had been examined by more than 50 different doctors. All of them described her as a monster. They called her a danger to society and a threat to humanity, a girl who would ruin our world and had already begun by murdering a small child. At 16, her parents suggested she be locked away, and so she was. None of it made sense to me. A girl cast off by society, by her own family. She had to contain so much feeling, rage. Depression, resentment. Where was it? She was nothing like the other inmates at the asylum, the ones who were truly disturbed. Some would spend hours hurling themselves at the wall, breaking bones and fracturing skulls. Others were so deranged they would claw at their own skin until they drew blood, literally ripping themselves to pieces. Some had entire conversations with themselves out loud, laughing and singing and arguing. Most would tear their clothes off, content to sleep and stand naked in their own filth. She was the only one who showered regularly or even washed her clothes. She would take her meals calmly, always finishing whatever she was given. and she spent most of her time staring out the window. She'd been locked up for almost a year and had not lost her sense of humanity. I wanted to know how she could suppress so much, how she'd achieved such outward calm. I'd asked for profiles on the other prisoners because I wanted comparisons. I wanted to know if her behavior was normal. It wasn't. I watched the unassuming outline of this girl I could not see and did not know, and I felt an unbelievable amount of respect for her. I admired her, envied her composure, her steadiness in the face of all she'd been forced to endure. I don't know that I understood what it was exactly I was feeling at the time, but I knew I wanted her all to myself. I wanted to know her secrets. And then one day, she stood up in her cell and walked over to the window. It was early morning, just as the sun was rising. I caught a glimpse of her face for the very first time. She pressed her palm to the window and whispered two words, just once. "Forgive me." I hit rewind too many times. I could never tell anyone I'd developed a newfound fascination with her. I had to affect a pretense, an outward indifference, an arrogance toward her. She was to be our weapon and nothing more, just an innovative instrument of torture. A detail I cared very little about. My research had led me to her files by pure accident. Coincidence. I did not seek her out in search of a weapon. I never had. Far before I'd ever seen her on film, and far, far before I ever spoke a word to her, I had been researching something else. For something else. My motives were my own. Utilizing her as a weapon was a story I fed to my father. I needed an excuse to have access to her, to gain the necessary clearance to study her files. It was a charade I was forced to maintain in front of my soldiers and the hundreds of cameras that monitor my existence. I did not bring her on base to exploit her ability, and I certainly did not expect to fall for her in the process. But these truths, and my real motivations, will be buried with me. I fall hard onto the bed, clap a hand over my forehead, drag it down the length of my face. I never would have sent Kent to stay with her if I could have taken the time to go myself. Every move I made was a mistake. Every calculated effort was a failure. I only wanted to watch her interact with someone. I wondered if she'd seem different, if she'd shatter the expectations I'd already formed in my mind by simply having a normal conversation. But watching her talk to someone else made me crazy. I was jealous. Ridiculous. I wanted her to know me. I wanted her to talk to me. And I felt it then. This strange, inexplicable sense that she might be the only person in the world I could really care about. I forced myself to sit up. I hazard a glance at the notebook still clutched in my hand. I lost her. She hates me. She hates me, and I repulse her, and I might never see her again, and it is entirely my own doing. This notebook might be all I have left of her. My hand is still hovering over the cover, tempting me to open it and find her again, even if it's only for a short while, even if it's only on paper. But part of me is terrified. This might not end well. This might not be anything I want to see. And so help me, if this turns out to be some kind of diary concerning her thoughts and feelings about Kent, I might just throw myself out the window. I pound my fist against my forehead, take a long, steadying breath. Finally, I flip it open. My eyes fall to the first page. And only then do I begin to understand the weight of what I've found. I keep thinking I need to stay calm, that it's all in my head, that everything is going to be fine and someone is going to open the door now. Someone is going to let me out of here. I keep thinking it's going to happen,
I keep thinking it has to happen. Because things like this don't just happen. This doesn't happen. People aren't forgotten like this. Not abandoned like this. This doesn't just happen. My face is caked with blood from when they threw me on the ground, and my hands are still shaking even as I write this. This pen is my only outlet, my only voice, because I have no one else to speak to, no mind but my own to drown in, and all the lifeboats are taken, and all the life preservers are broken, and I don't know how to swim. I can't swim, I can't swim, and it's getting so hard. It's getting so hard. It's like there are a million screams caught inside of my chest, but I have to keep them all in. Because what's the point of screaming if you'll never be heard? And no one will ever hear me in here. No one will ever hear me again. I've learned to stare at things. The walls, my hands, the cracks in the walls, the lines on my fingers, the shades of gray in the concrete, the shape of my fingernails. I pick one thing and stare at it for what must be hours. I keep time in my head by counting the seconds as they pass. I keep days in my head by writing them down. Today is day two. Today is the second day. Today is a day. Today. It's so cold. It's so cold. It's so cold. Please, please, please.
I slam the cover shut. I'm shaking again, and this time I can't stop it. This time the shaking is coming from deep within my core, from a profound realization of what I'm holding in my hands. This journal is not from her time spent here. It has nothing to do with me, or Kent, or anyone at all. This journal is a documentation of her days spent in the asylum. And suddenly, this small, battered notebook means more to me than anything I've ever owned. 10. I don't even know how I managed to get myself back to my own room so quickly. All I know is that I've locked the door to my bedroom, unlocked the door to my office, only to lock myself inside. And now I'm sitting here, at my desk, stacks of papers and confidential material shoved out of the way, staring at the tattered cover of something I'm very nearly terrified to read. There's something so personal about this journal. It looks as if it's been bound together by the loneliest feelings, the most vulnerable moments of one person's life. She wrote whatever lies within these pages during some of the darkest hours of her 17 years. And I'm about to get exactly what I've always wanted. A look into her mind. And though the anticipation is killing me, I'm also acutely aware of just how badly this might backfire. I'm suddenly not sure I even want to know. And yet I do. I definitely do. So I open the book and turn to the next page. Day 3.
I started screaming today.
And those 4 words hit me harder than the worst kind of physical pain. My chest is rising and falling, my breath's coming in too hard. I have to force myself to keep reading. I soon realize there's no order to the pages. She seems to have started back at the beginning after she came to the end of the notebook and realized she'd run out of space. She's written in the margins, over other paragraphs, in tiny and nearly illegible fonts. There are numbers scrawled all over everything, sometimes the same number repeating over and over and over again. Sometimes the same word has been written and rewritten, circled and underlined. And nearly every page has sentences and paragraphs almost entirely crossed out. It's complete chaos. My heart constricts at this realization, at this proof of what she must have experienced. I'd hypothesized about what she might have suffered in all that time, locked up in such dark, horrifying conditions. But seeing it for myself, I wish I weren't right. And now, even as I try to read in chronological order, I find I'm unable to keep up with the method she's used to number everything. The system she created on these pages is something only she'd be able to decipher. I can only flip through the book and seek out the bits that are most coherently written. My eyes freeze on a particular passage.
It's a strange thing to never know peace. To know that no matter where you go, there is no sanctuary. That the threat of pain is always a whisper away. I'm not safe locked into these four walls. I was never safe leaving my house. And I couldn't even feel safe in the 14 years I lived at home. The asylum kills people every day. The world has already been taught to fear me. And my home is the same place where my father locked me in my room every night, and my mother screamed at me for being the abomination she was forced to raise. She always said it was my face. There was something about my face, she said, that she couldn't stand. Something about my eyes, the way I looked at her, the fact that I even existed. She'd always tell me to stop looking at her. She'd always scream it, like I might attack her. Stop looking at me, she'd scream. You just stop looking at me, she'd scream. She put my hand in the fire once. Just to see if it would burn, she said. Just to check if it was a regular hand, she said. I was 6 years old then. I remember because it was my birthday.
I knocked the notebook to the floor. I'm upright in an instant, trying to steady my heart. I run a hand through my hair, my fingers caught at the roots. These words are too close to me, too familiar. The story of a child abused by its parents, locked away and discarded. It's too close to my mind. I've never read anything like this before. I've never read anything that could speak directly to my bones. And I know I shouldn't. I know somehow that it won't help. That it won't teach me anything. That it won't give me clues about where she might have gone. I already know that reading this will only make me crazy. But I can't stop myself from reaching for her journal once more. I flip it open again.
Am I insane yet?
Crossed out.
Has it happened yet?
Crossed out.
How will I ever know?
Crossed out. My intercom screeches so suddenly that I trip over my own chair and have to catch myself on the wall behind my desk. My hands won't stop shaking, my forehead is beaded with sweat. My bandaged arm has begun to burn, and my legs are suddenly too weak to stand on. I have to focus all my energy on sounding normal as I accept the incoming message. What? I demand.
Sir, I only wondered if you were still... Well... The assembly, sir. Unless, of course, I got the time wrong. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have bothered you.
Oh, for the love of God, De La Lu. I try to shake off the tremble in my voice. Stop apologizing. I'm on my way.
Yes, sir,
he says. Thank you, sir. I disconnect the line. And then I grab the notebook, tuck it in my pocket, and head out the door. 11. I'm standing at the edge of the courtyard above the quadrant, looking out at the thousands of faces staring back at me. These are my soldiers, standing single-file line in their assembly uniforms, black shirts, black pants, black boots. No guns. Left fists pressed against their hearts. I make an effort to focus on and care about the task at hand. But somehow I can't help but be hyper-aware of the notebook tucked away in my pocket, the shape of it pressing against my leg and torturing me with its secrets. I am not myself. My thoughts are tangled in words that are not my own. I have to take a sharp breath to clear my head. I clench and unclench my fist. Sector 45, I say, speaking directly into the square of microphonic mesh. They shift at once, dropping their left hands and instead placing their right fists on their chests. "We have a number of important things to discuss today," I tell them, "the first of which is readily apparent." I gesture to my arm, study their carefully crafted emotionless faces. Their traitorous thoughts are so obvious. They think of me as little more than a deranged child. They do not respect me, they are not loyal to me. They are disappointed that I stand before them, angry, disgusted even, that I am not dead of this wound. But they do fear me. And that is all I require. "I was injured," I say, "while in pursuit of two of our defecting soldiers, Private Adam Kent and Private Kenji Kishimoto, collaborated their escape in an effort to abduct Juliet Ferrars, our newest transfer and critical asset to Sector 45. They have been charged with the crime of unlawfully seizing and detaining Ms. Ferrars against her will. But, and most importantly, they have been rightly convicted of treason against the reestablishment. When found, they will be executed on sight." Terror, I realize, is one of the easiest feelings to read, even on a soldier's stoic face. "Second," I say more slowly this time, "in an effort to expedite the process of stabilizing Sector 45, its citizens, and the ensuing chaos resulting from these recent disruptions, the Supreme Commander of the Reestablishment has joined us on base. He arrived, I tell them, not 36 hours ago." Some men have dropped their fists, forgotten themselves. Their eyes are wide, petrified. "You will welcome him," I say. They drop to their knees. It's strange, wielding this kind of power. I wonder if my father is proud of what he's created, that I'm able to bring thousands of grown men to their knees with only a few words, with only the sound of his title. It's a horrifying, addicting kind of thing. I count 5 beats in my head. "Rise." They do. And then they march. 5 steps backward, forward, standing in place. They raise their left arms, curl their fingers into fists, and fall on one knee. This time, I do not let them up. "Prepare yourselves, gentlemen," I say to them. "We will not rest until Kent and Kishimoto are found and Ms. Ferrars has returned to base. I will confer with the Supreme Commander in these next 24 hours. Our newest mission will soon be clearly defined. In the interim, you are to understand 2 things. First, that we will diffuse the tension among the citizens and take pains to remind them of their promises to our new world. And second, be certain that we will find Privates Kent and Kishimoto." I stop, look around, focusing on their faces. "Let their fate serve as an example to you. We do not welcome traitors in the reestablishment, and we do not forgive." 12. One of my father's men is waiting for me outside my door. I glance in his direction, but not long enough to discern his features. "State your business, soldier."
"Sir," he says, "I've been instructed to inform you that the Supreme Commander requests your presence in his quarters for dinner at 2000 hours.
"Consider your message received." I move to unlock my door. He steps forward, blocking my path. I turn to face him. He's standing less than a foot away from me, an implicit act of disrespect, a level of comfort even Delalu does not allow himself. but unlike my men, the sycophants who surround my father consider themselves lucky. Being a member of the Supreme Commander's elite guard is considered a privilege and an honor. They answer to no one but him. And right now, this soldier is trying to prove he outranks me. He's jealous of me. He thinks I'm unworthy of being the son of the Supreme Commander of the Reestablishment. It's practically written on his face. I have to stifle my impulse to laugh as I take in his cold gray eyes and the black pit that is his soul. He wears his sleeves rolled up above his elbows, his military tattoos clearly defined and on display. The concentric black bands of ink around his forearms are accented in red, green, and blue, the only sign on his person to indicate that he is a soldier highly elevated in rank. It's a sick branding ritual I've always refused to be a part of. The soldier is still staring at me. I incline my head in his direction, raise my eyebrows. "I am required," he says, "to wait for verbal acceptance of this invitation." I take a moment to consider my choices, which are none. I, like the rest of the puppets in this world, am entirely subservient to my father's will. It's a truth I'm forced to contend with every day, that I've never been able to stand up to the man who has his fist clenched around my spine. It makes me hate myself. I meet the soldier's eyes again and wonder, for a fleeting moment, if he has a name, before I realize I couldn't possibly care less. "Consider it accepted." "Yes, and next time, soldier, you will not step within 5 feet of me without first asking permission." He blinks, stunned. "Sir, you are confused." I cut him off. "You assume your work with the Supreme Commander grants you immunity from rules that govern the lives of other soldiers. Here, you are mistaken." His jaw tenses. "Never forget," I say quietly now, "that if I wanted your job, I could have it. And never forget that the man you so eagerly serve is the same man who taught me how to fire a gun when I was 9 years old." His nostrils flare. He stares straight ahead. "Deliver your message, soldier, and then memorize this one. Do not ever speak to me again." His eyes are focused on a point directly behind me now, his shoulders rigid. I wait. His jaw is still tight. He slowly lifts his hand in salute. "You are dismissed," I say. I lock my bedroom door behind me and lean against it. I need just a moment. I reach for the bottle I left on my nightstand and shake out two of the square pills. I toss them into my mouth, closing my eyes as they dissolve. The darkness behind my eyelids is a welcome relief, until the memory of her face forces itself into my consciousness. I sit down on my bed and drop my head into my hand. I shouldn't be thinking about her right now. I have hours of paperwork to sort through, and the additional stress of my father's presence to contend with. Dinner with him should be a spectacle, a soul-crushing spectacle. I squeeze my eyes shut tighter and make a weak effort to build the walls that would surely clear my mind, but this time they don't work. Her face keeps cropping up, her journal taunting me from its place in my pocket, and I begin to realize that some small part of me doesn't want to wish away the thoughts of her. Some part of me enjoys the torture. This girl is destroying me. A girl who has spent the last year in an insane asylum. A girl who would try to shoot me dead for kissing her. A girl who ran off with another man just to get away from me. Of course, this is the girl I would fall for. I close a hand over my mouth. I am losing my mind. I tug off my boots, pull myself up onto my bed, and allow my head to hit the pillows behind me. She slept here, I think. She slept in my bed. She woke up in my bed. She was here, and I let her get away. I failed. I lost her. I don't even realize I've tugged her notebook out of my pocket until I'm holding it in front of my face, staring at it, studying the faded cover, in an attempt to understand where she might have acquired such a thing. She must have stolen it from somewhere, though I can't imagine where. There are so many things I want to ask her, so many things I wish I could say to her. Instead, I open her journal and read. Sometimes I close my eyes and paint these walls a different color. I imagine I'm wearing warm socks and sitting by a fire. I imagine someone's given me a book to read, a story to take me away from the torture of my own mind. I want to be someone else, somewhere else, with something else to fill my mind. I want to run, to feel the wind tug at my hair. I want to pretend that this is just a story within a story, that this cell is just a scene, that these hands don't belong to me, that this window leads to somewhere beautiful if only I could break it. I pretend this pillow is clean. I pretend this bed is soft. I pretend and pretend and pretend until the world becomes so breathtaking behind my eyelids that I can no longer contain it. But then my eyes fly open, and I'm caught around the throat by a pair of hands that won't stop suffocating, suffocating, suffocating. My thoughts, I think, will soon be sound. My mind, I hope, will soon be found. The journal drops out of my hand and onto my chest. I run my only free hand across my face through my hair. I rub the back of my neck and haul myself up so fast that my head hits the headboard and I'm actually grateful. I take a moment to appreciate the pain. And then I pick up the book and turn the page.
I wonder what they're thinking. My parents. I wonder where they are. I wonder if they're okay now. If they're happy now. If they finally got what they wanted.
Crossed out.
I wonder if my mother will ever have another child. I wonder if someone will ever be kind enough to kill me. And I wonder if hell is better than here. I wonder what my face looks like now. I wonder if I'll ever breathe fresh air again. I wonder about so many things. Sometimes I'll stay awake for days just counting everything I can find. I count the walls, the cracks in the walls, my fingers and toes. I count the springs in the bed, the threads in the blanket, the steps it takes to cross the room and back. I count my teeth and the individual hairs on my head, and the number of seconds I can hold my breath. But sometimes I get so tired that I forget I'm not allowed to wish for things anymore, and I find myself wishing for the one thing I've always wanted, the only thing I've always dreamt about. I wish all the time for a friend. I dream about it. I imagine what it would be like to smile and be smiled upon, to have a person to confide in, someone who wouldn't throw things at me or stick my hands in the fire or beat me for being born, someone who would hear that I'd been thrown away and would try to find me, who would never be afraid of me, someone who'd know I'd never try to hurt them. I fold myself into a corner of this room and bury my head in my knees, and rock back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and I wish and I wish and I wish. And I dream of impossible things until I've cried myself to sleep. I wonder what it would be like to have a friend. And then I wonder who else is locked in this asylum. I wonder where the other screams are coming from, I wonder if they're coming from me.
I'm trying to focus, telling myself these are just empty words, but I'm lying. Because somehow just reading these words is too much. And the thought of her in pain is causing me an unbearable amount of agony. To know that she experienced this. She was thrown into this by her own parents, cast off and abused her entire life. Empathy is not an emotion I've ever known, but now it's drowning me, pulling me into a world I never knew I could enter. And though I've always believed she and I shared many things in common, I did not know how deeply I could feel it. It's killing me. I stand up, start pacing the length of my bedroom until I've finally worked up the nerve to keep reading. Then I take a deep breath and turn the page.
There's something simmering inside of me,
crossed out.
Something I've never dared to tap into, something I'm afraid to acknowledge,
crossed out.
There's a part of me clawing to break free from the cage I've trapped it in, banging on the doors of my heart, begging to be free,
crossed out.
Begging to let go,
crossed out.
Every day I feel like I'm reliving the same nightmare,
crossed out.
I open my mouth to shout, to fight, to swing my fists, but my vocal cords are cut, my arms are heavy and weighted down as if trapped in wet cement,
crossed out.
And I'm screaming, but no one can hear me, no one can reach me, and I'm caught and it's killing me,
crossed out.
I've always had to make myself submissive, subservient, twisted into a pleading, passive mop just to make everyone else feel safe and comfortable,
crossed out.
My existence has become a fight to prove I'm harmless, that I'm not a threat, that I'm capable of living among other human beings without hurting them,
crossed out.
And I'm so tired, I'm so tired, I'm so tired, I'm so tired, and sometimes I get so angry,
crossed out.
I don't know what's happening to me.
God, Juliet, I gasp and fall to my knees. Call for transport immediately. I need to get out. I need to get out right now.
Sir, I mean, yes, sir, of course, but where?
I have to visit the compounds, I say. I should make my rounds before my meeting this evening. This is both true and false. But I'm willing to do anything right now that might get my mind off this journal.
Oh, certainly, sir. Would you like me to accompany you?
That won't be necessary, Lieutenant, but thank you for the offer.
Sir, he stammers. Of course it is my pleasure, sir, to assist you.
Good God, I have taken leave of my senses. I never thank De La Lue. I've likely given the poor man a heart attack. I will be ready to go in 10 minutes. I cut him off. He stutters to a stop. Then,
yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
I'm pressing my fist to my mouth as the call disconnects. 13.
We had homes before. All different kinds. One-story homes, two-story homes, three-story homes. We bought lawn ornaments and twinkle lights, learned to ride bikes without training wheels. We purchased lives confined within one, two, three stories already built, stories caught inside of structures we could not change. We lived in those stories for a while. We followed the tale laid out for us, the pros pinned down in every square foot of space we'd acquired. We were content with the plot twists that only mildly redirected our lives. We signed on the dotted line for the things we didn't know we cared about. We ate the things we shouldn't, spent money when we couldn't, lost sight of the earth we had to inhabit, and wasted, wasted, wasted everything. Food, water, resources. Soon the skies were gray with chemical pollution. And the plants and animals were sick from genetic modification, and diseases rooted themselves in our air, our meals, our blood and bones. The food disappeared. The people were dying. our empire fell to pieces. The reestablishment said they would help us, save us, rebuild our society. Instead, they tore us all apart.
I enjoy coming to the compounds. It's an odd place to seek refuge, but there's something about seeing so many civilians in such a vast, open space that reminds me of what I'm meant to be doing. I'm so often confined within the walls of Sector 45 headquarters that I forget the faces of those we're fighting and those we're fighting for. I like to remember. Most days, I visit each cluster on the compounds. I greet the residents and ask about their living conditions. I can't help but be curious about what life must be like for them now, because while the world changed for everyone else, it always stayed the same for me. Regimented, isolated, bleak. There was a time when things were better, when my father wasn't always so angry. I was about 4 years old then. He used to let me sit on his lap and search his pockets. I'd get to keep anything I wanted as long as my argument was convincing enough. It was his idea of a game. But this was all before. I wrap my coat more tightly around my body, feel the material press against my back. I flinch without meaning to. The life I know now is the only one that matters. The suffocation, the luxury, the sleepless nights, and the dead bodies. I've always been taught to focus on power and pain, gaining and inflicting. I grieve nothing. I take everything. It's the only way I know how to live in this battered body. I empty my mind of the things that plague me and burden my soul, and I take all that I can from what little pleasantness comes my way. I do not know what it is to live a normal life. I do not know how to sympathize with the civilians who've lost their homes. I do not know what it must have been like for them before the reestablishment took over. So, I enjoy touring the compounds. I enjoy seeing how other people live. I like that the law requires them to answer my questions. I would have no way of knowing otherwise. But my timing is off. I paid little attention to the clock before I left base and didn't realize how soon the sun would be setting. Most civilians are returning home to retire for the evening, their bodies bowed, huddled against the cold as they shuffle toward the metal clusters they share with at least three other families. These makeshift homes are built from 40-foot shipping containers. They're stacked side by side and on top of one another, lumped together in groups of four and six. Each container has been insulated, fitted with two windows and one door. Stairs to the upper levels are attached on either side. The roofs are lined with solar panels that provide free electricity for each grouping. It's something I'm proud of, because it was my idea. When we were seeking temporary shelter for the civilians, I suggested refurbishing the old shipping containers that line the docks of every port around the world. Not only are they cheap, easily replicated, and highly customizable, but they're stackable, portable, and built to withstand the elements. They'd require minimal construction, and with the right team, thousands of housing units could be ready in a matter of days. I'd pitched the idea to my father, thinking it might be the most effective option, a temporary solution that would be far less cruel than tents, something that would provide true, reliable shelter. But the result was so effective that the reestablishment saw no need to upgrade. Here, on land that used to be a landfill, we've stacked thousands of containers, clusters of faded, rectangular cubes that are easy to monitor and keep track of. The people are still told that these homes are temporary, that one day they will return to the memories of their old lives, and that things will be bright and beautiful again. But this is all a lie. The reestablishment has no plans to move them. Civilians are caged on these regulated grounds. These containers have become their prisons. Everything has been numbered. The people, their homes, their level of importance to the reestablishment. Here, They've become a part of a huge experiment, a world wherein they work to support the needs of a regime that makes them promises it will never fulfill. This is my life, this sorry world. Most days I feel just as caged as these civilians, and that's likely why I always come here. It's like running from one prison to another, an existence wherein there is no relief, no refuge, where even my own mind is a traitor. I should be stronger than this. I've been training for just over a decade. Every day I've worked to hone my physical and mental strengths. I'm 5'9" and 170 pounds of muscle. I've been built to survive, to maximize endurance and stamina, and I'm most comfortable when I'm holding a gun in my hand. I can field strip, clean, reload, disassemble, and reassemble more than 150 different types of firearms. I can shoot a target through the center from almost any distance. I can break a person's windpipe with only the edge of my hand. I can temporarily paralyze a man with nothing but my knuckles. On the battlefield, I'm able to disconnect myself from the motions I've been taught to memorize. I've developed a reputation as a cold, unfeeling monster who fears nothing and cares for less. But this is all very deceiving. Because the truth is, I am nothing but a coward. 14. The sun is setting. Soon I'll have no choice but to return to base, or I'll have to sit still and listen to my father speak instead of shooting a bullet through his open mouth. So I stall for time. I watch from afar as the children run around while their parents herd them home. I wonder about how one day they'll get old enough to realize that the reestablishment registration cards they carry are actually tracking their every movement, that the money their parents make from working in whichever factories they were sorted into is closely monitored. These children will grow up and finally understand that everything they do is recorded, every conversation dissected for whispers of rebellion. They don't know that profiles are created for every citizen, and that every profile is thick with documentation on their friendships, relationships, and work habits, even the ways in which they choose to spend their free time. We know everything about everyone. Too much. So much, in fact, that I seldom remember we're dealing with real, live people until I see them on the compounds. I've memorized the names of nearly every person in Sector 45. I like to know who lives within my jurisdiction, soldiers and civilians alike. That's how I knew, for example, that Private Seamus Fletcher, 45B-76423, was beating his wife and children every night. I knew he was spending all his money on alcohol. I knew he'd been starving his family. I monitored the rest dollars he spent at our supply centers and carefully observed his family on the compounds. I knew his three children were all under the age of 10 and hadn't eaten in weeks. I knew that they'd repeatedly been to the compound's medic for broken bones and stitches. I knew he'd punched his 9-year-old daughter in the mouth and split her lip, fractured her jaw, and broken her 2 front teeth. And I knew his wife was pregnant. I also knew that he hit her so hard one night that she lost the child the following morning. I knew because I was there. I'd been stopping by each residence, visiting with the civilians, asking questions about their health and overall living situations. I'd wanted to know about their work conditions and whether any members of their family were ill and needed to be quarantined. She was there that day, Fletcher's wife. Her nose was broken so badly that both her eyes had swollen shut. Her frame was so thin and frail, her color so sallow, that I thought she might snap in half just by sitting down. But when I asked about her injuries, she wouldn't look me in the eye. She said she'd fallen down, that because of her fall, she'd lost the pregnancy, and managed to break her nose in the process. I nodded, thanked her for her cooperation in answering my questions. And then I called for an assembly. I'm well aware that the majority of my soldiers steal from our storage compounds. I oversee our inventory closely, and I know that supplies go missing all the time. But I allow these infractions because they do not upset the system. A few extra loaves of bread or bars of soap keep my soldiers in better spirits. They work harder if they are healthy, and most are supporting spouses, children, and relatives. So it is a concession I allow. But there are some things I do not forgive. I don't consider myself a moral man. I do not philosophize about life or bother with the laws and principles that govern most people. I do not pretend to know the difference between right and wrong. But I do live by a certain kind of code, and sometimes, I think, you have to learn how to shoot first. Seamus Fletcher was murdering his family, and I shot him in the forehead because I thought it'd be kinder than ripping him to pieces by hand. But my father picked up where Fletcher left off. My father had three children and their mother shot.